the keep rating for the next several days.
Yes, mudslides.
Sliding mud.
People not. You notice that you could probably tell that's as much of a choice for anybody to be out driving, because when it's raining like this, hardly anybody's out.
Well, you know how it is. No one in their right mind, which leaves the rest of us.
Which is why we drove straight over here.
Yes.
All right. As promised, we will talk about this book. And you know what, Bill? Since you're being so nice about it, I think it was going to be the second half of the show. Now we've only got a half hour of the first half. We can talk about your book, unless you want to take an entire show for that next time,
well,
or when it comes out.
It's not out yet, but it's on its way.
Uh-huh.
But no, we're here to talk about your book.
And, all right.
I'm very curious as to who this weird guy Moore is that you keep talking about in there, because I've been reading this book, and he keeps popping up. I guess what I'm really interested in exploring first off is the question of Paul Benowitz and his Project Beta,
mm-hmm.
and why it is that people of his caliber so often, when they become enmeshed in the UFO phenomenon, begin to lose all contact with propriety, reality, and common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Paul is certainly a strong candidate for that that sort of characterization. But why do you think that is? I mean, having probably explored this this situation more than anybody else has. Even more than me, because you brought out things in your book that I didn't know until you wrote them. So we have to say you're the expert here on Benowitz. Certainly the story revolves around Benowitz's credulity.
Right.
The fact that he was so willing to accept all of this and run with it,
mm-hmm.
and make all the noises that he made and in all the places that he made them. And so I was wondering if you maybe had some perspective on why you feel that that a man of Benowitz's caliber could get so involved in a situation like this that it literally took him down with it.
You know, that might be one of the problems addressed by the Publisher's Weekly review, which said that the character seemed a little two-dimensional. Yes, it is. We're back on. The reason for this, I'll in my quest to give you an answer that will probably not be a good answer, I want to explain to you how I found out, how I kind of rounded out who Paul Benowitz was, and I didn't really. The reason is because everybody I talked to said, I didn't know much about Paul. All he talked to me about was his UFO stuff. He seemed to be very private, and if he didn't want to talk to you about something, he wouldn't. And he wasn't talkative except about the UFO subject and what he was finding out. He didn't talk about his business, his personal life, his children, as far as I could tell. Gabe Valdez, who knew him fairly well, probably as well as you or anybody else, at least the people I talked to, said the same thing. Although he had been to his house, he had seen his setup there with the video screens and everything, but didn't really get any sense of what kind of person Paul was, based on even the contact he had with him, which is probably a little bit more than you or Richard Doty. So the only thing I knew about him really was that he was interested in Wild West novels, is because I think you told me that was the one thing that you knew about him that was personal. No one else could tell me something, that kind of thing. Now, I don't know what the reason Paul, I could make guesses as to why he got interested in the UFO subject. He was interested in it before. He was a member of APRO before all this started happening. Area Phenomena Research Organization, and was interested in the subject, interested in cattle mutilations, things like that. Those were just starting in the mid-70s. And if I was to take a guess as to why this took over his life, you have to be sort of an obsessive person to start and run a successful business like Paul did. That was his one obsession, one of his obsessions. And maybe the only other thing he did for quote-unquote amusement was to delve into this UFO thing. And maybe he felt like he had found something with these lights over Kirtland and what became what he thought was an alien invasion. something that mattered a lot more than his business. I mean, you and other people have told me that his business just fell off, and he had other people taking care of it. His sons eventually ran it. His assistant, this Chinese guy, I think you said, that helped him build some of these devices where he was picking up these signals, etc. I think that he gave up one sort of work, which was his technical work, for another sort, which he thought, you know, one, was probably a lot more important. To him, it was a lot more important. And two, it was a hell of a lot more interesting. And that's why I think a lot of people that are into UFOs do this, because it's something very interesting. I mean, granted, it's a hobby. There's only a few people that are professional ufologists. I think probably one of them being Stan Friedman. I guess he makes a living off his books and his talks.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. But people need to, you know, a lot of people need to support themselves. Paul was lucky. He had started this company, and he just could live off the little bit that he was getting from the company and still feed his family, etc. And his family, as I've said before, absolutely did not want to talk about it. It was an embarrassing episode and kind of a heartbreaking episode for them, too. I think that answers a little bit of your question. That's as far as I can take it.
Well, Paul, you know, he gave me the impression that at least toward the end, that he felt that he alone was in a position to save the world from a terrible fate, and he was sort of a voice crying in the wilderness, trying to get people to listen, and yet people just sort of dismissed him at that point. I remember reading the very first fairly lengthy communication from him to APRO, which I think, if I recall correctly, Jim Lorenzen told me that this was the second letter that he had received on the topic. I don't believe I ever did read the first one. But I do remember reading that was my first exposure to Benowitz and what he was doing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that it had something of a scientific tone to it. You could tell this man was a logical thinker, that he was a scientist, that he was making an effort to try to attack this in some sensible, methodical way, and yet it seemed as if as time went by, he just got worse and worse and worse, to the point where you couldn't tell him anything, you couldn't really get through to him. He was, as you say, obsessed with the situation, and I think that's what the government exploited. You know, they simply saw that as his weakness and ran with it. It was a convenient thing, and he was easily programmed at that point. And I think once they got the computer program into his hands that enabled him to, quote, decipher, unquote, some of those supposed messages he was getting, that he just really went off the rails at that point. He was talking about orange bases and Swedes and aliens of several different varieties. And I remember one time going into his laboratory, and he was very, very excited. He had something to show me. He had to show me right away. And so we went upstairs, and here was this little cathode ray screen. The thing was only a couple of inches across.
Yeah,
and
he had an oscilloscope.
He had an image on it.
Hmm.
And the image, as far as I could see, was nothing but static. But yet he was absolutely sure that there was an alien face in that image.
It's funny, because other people said they saw such things. And Gabe said he did witness that kind of thing at Ball's house. Now, I don't know about Gabe's powers of observation. He's a highway patrol officer. He doesn't seem too credulous. So
I think Gabe was a highly competent man. Any experiences I had with him, he certainly knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And was very careful about it. And I don't believe I ever caught him making any wild statements that he couldn't support.
Yeah, he seemed puzzled by it. He said,
very
I saw
so.
What Paul saw.
Very much so. If Gabe saw any images in or any faces in those images, I certainly couldn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
I did have an experience while I was there in his lab, which I to this day can't explain. And that was, I didn't see anything. It had to do with a feeling of heat.
You haven't mentioned this before.
I was looking at his I think it's three different screens.
This was in his home lab in the den.
This was in his lab upstairs.
Yeah.
And
next to the bedroom.
He was claiming that he could determine if there was a UFO hovering over his area, basically.
He had a UFO detector.
Yeah, and that if it were, it would show up on this screen, and you could see it as a blip or a point.
Right.
And there were three screens because, obviously, he was covering three different angles, as I recall it. And so he was going to demonstrate this for me, and he turned this machinery, this equipment on, and sure enough, there were three images that showed up on the screen. He says, well, there are three of them up there. And he started explaining how this worked, and all of a sudden he stopped. And he said, they know you're here. And I said, what do you mean?
Who?
They know I'm here. I said, what are you saying? He says, they know you're here. He says, they've just scanned you. And I said, well, okay, how do you know that? And he says, because this detector I've got over here, and he showed me a readout that he was getting with a little, like an earthquake, an oscilloscope or whatever, an earthquake.
A seismograph.
Yeah. That's what I'm looking for. The seismograph with a pen on it that gives you
a sort of like that or a lie detector.
And the thing went off the scale. It went clear off the edge of the paper. And he said, that happens when they scan you with this beam. He says, if they do it again, he says, you'll feel it. And at that point, I felt as if I was having a terrific hot flash. I just got real dizzy and real lightheaded and real hot. And it only lasted a few seconds, and then it was gone. And he said, did you feel that? And I said, well, I felt something. And he said, they just scanned you again. And they know who you are and why you're here. And so I filed that sort of away for
future
reference.
Why didn't you tell me this when we were talking about the book?
I probably thought I had. But I never knew what to make of that experience. But
you heard it here first.
There it was. And certainly something had happened, but just what had happened, I don't know. I don't know whether there was actually a scanning beam that went past or what. All I know is that this thing went off the edge of the paper, and I felt real lightheaded and dizzy and hot at the same moment.
Yeah. Well, there's several possible explanations. The first one, Benowitz did it himself consciously. The second one, Benowitz did it himself unconsciously somehow. Third one is it came through his equipment somehow, and it is. We have the phone ringing, but we're still talking here. We'll take questions here in probably about half an hour. Another explanation I can think of is there were, a third likely one is there were humans out there doing something, and they just wanted to demonstrate to you or Paul that they could do this anytime they wanted or further screw up Paul. Or the fourth one was there was aliens out there doing exactly what he said they were.
Well, I can't say what it was. I just know that I had that experience, and that was one of several strange things that happened over the course of time there. So there was something going on beyond the normal pale, but just what it was. But going back to your own experiences, now, you chased around the Southwest and talked to quite a lot of people in one context or another connected with this thing. Of all of the ones that you talked to and mentioned in your book, who would you say was perhaps the most useful to you, the most helpful to you?
You and a guy I called
aside from me, of course.
And a guy that I referred to in the book is Lou Miles. He didn't want me to use his name in the book, but since we're on the radio, I hope he doesn't mind, is Jerry Miller.
Ah.
Jerry Miller, and he wasn't helpful because he sat there and answered my questions directly. And you probably know this about Jerry. He was helpful in that he would say things out of context which answered a question that I either not asked, but he knew I wanted to ask, or that I had asked, but it was the day before or a couple hours ago.
That's Jerry.
Yes. And I did not realize this until I left New Mexico and I was writing the book. Jerry got very disinterested in talking to me when I got home. He didn't want to answer the emails. He didn't answer a phone call. I figured that's all he wanted to say about it. But I think what he was doing was telling me, I told you things that I shouldn't have told anybody, or maybe
hinted at things.
But he would. I'll give you an example. Let me think of a good. I was trying to figure out one of the things that Paul was seeing. These are the best questions I've been asked yet. I was trying to figure out one of the things that Paul was seeing. What he was seeing. Any number of things on the base, on Kirtland Air Force Base there. What the NSA and the AFOSI were so bothered about. And Jerry. I think I remember as a direct query when I asked him, said there were so many things going on there, it could have been any of a number of things, but I'm not sure what it was. And I was pretty sure he knew what at least a couple of them were. So the next day, and we talked about a lot of other things besides the case, religion and things. He's very, very interested in spiritual concerns.
Yes, he is.
I find that fascinating with him being a scientist in the position he was in. Which was a pretty high position in the defense department and industry. He was the director of space and satellite intelligence or something like that for the DIA. I can't remember his title. I found it later from a document that Bob Wood very kindly lent me. The next day, I called him up because I couldn't get... I remember I called you and I said, they turned me away at the gate. They told me not to come back. I have no authorization to be on the base because we thought the Atomic Museum was still there.
Right.
I was very depressed about this because Benowitz's son had just told me to get lost in no uncertain terms. And so I couldn't get on the base. I felt like I was ruining the Benowitz family life by doing any of this. And... I think you said, well, you know, go look at the atomic. No, you suggested I go to the Atomic Museum, and I was turned away because they'd moved off base mm-hmm. after September 11th.
I hadn't realized.
I called Jerry in some sort of desperation, and I said, Jerry, do you know of any way of getting on the base legitimately without having to wait for, you know, weeks? And he said, one of the few times he was actually direct. He says, I think my ID will still work. He knew it would still work, but he just said that.
Yes.
He said, what are you doing at 3 o'clock? You know, it was like noon. I said, I have to go to the library to look up some things, but I'll be back at my hotel at 3. He said, okay, see you there then. And just like government people do, at 3 o'clock on the dot, his car pulls up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made sure I was out there because I know how they operate. And I got in, and he said... he said, let's go see if we can get on the base. He drove straight to the base, waved his ID, whoosh, right inside. So we drove around the base for probably about half an hour, and there were sirens going and, you know, military police everywhere, guards everywhere, people armed to the teeth. And we just sailed in and just drove around the base for a little while on the main road there that goes by where the trestle is,
mm-hmm.
the EMP testing platform, the old one that's still there. Drove as far up to Manzano, nuclear weapons storage as we could, probably maybe a half a mile away. And we started to turn around, and I said, Jerry, why are you turning around? And he said, well, my card gets me in the front, but I don't know if it gets me back here anymore. It might have, I don't know. I don't think he didn't want to get in trouble. He didn't want to take me any closer. But I did see the bunkers up there. And did I see the Starfire range? I think it's hidden enough. No, I did see it. I did. And this is what I was getting to. He said, oh, look, there's a Starfire range. There's some of the bunkers. You know, you can't. I said, oh, yeah, you can't see it from Albuquerque. They're hidden behind. They're, you know, specifically put on the back side of the mountain as it faces Albuquerque, so you can't see them. It just looks like a hill with some towers at the top. And as we're driving back, or as we see, he said, that's Starfire. And he said, oh, you know, there was this guy, Robert Fugate, that used to work there. I believe he still does. I said, yeah, he still does. I looked it up. He was an electrical physicist, engineer. I guess he was a PhD I'm not sure if it was electrical physics or optical physics or some sort of physicist. But he invented that adaptive optics system. He said, did you hear that he invented that system with the light? You know, it was something I hadn't heard of yet. But as I found out later from talking to a few other people, including Rick Doty, in a dodgy way that I asked him, I found out that was one of the things they didn't want Benowitz looking at, because that was the thing they were using to track satellites. And Jerry didn't say, well, I think one of the things was the satellites. And that thing that Dr. Fugate was doing with tracking the Russian satellites and controlling them and, you know, something that was very secret. He didn't say that. He said, oh, that Fugate guy was really smart. He used to work over there, and then he dropped it.
Which I guess is probably the smartest thing he could have done.
Yeah. Yeah, but there were a few other things like that. Now, most people would say, oh, well, that's no answer. That's not a good way to go about it. If he didn't answer you directly, that's wrong. But the thing is, a few of the things he hinted to me, or talked, not hinted, he was just talking about it in conversation. Mm-hmm. Days, weeks, months later, I would find out that he was telling me something. And that was very interesting to me, and I didn't really say that in the book. Because I didn't want to get people bothering Jerry that much. And I hope they won't if you're listening now. Leave Jerry alone. He does not want to be bothered.
I think that's good advice. Moving away from that, I noticed, just as a sort of general question here between us, that some of the plates seem to be missing from the book. I gather the publisher cut some of those at the last minute.
They could only get a certain amount, is what they told me. They had a certain amount of pages they could print that they had in their budget to have pictures.
Uh-huh.
What are you speaking of specifically?
Well, there's a reference in your book, for example, to a photo that was taken using Fugate's device of a satellite.
Yes.
And it says see plate, but yet when you see plate, you don't see plate.
There is a picture of the adaptive optics system in use. Those three pictures of a satellite,
yeah.
The blob, the...
But not the one that you showed me, which I remember looking at, it was quite clear.
Which one did I show you?
Don't ask me which one. I don't recall. I just remember you showing me one, and you could see quite clearly on it, and it's not the one that's in the book.
You could see what? The range?
No,
or
the satellite. You could see a satellite, a picture of a satellite.
I don't remember showing you another one besides this.
Yeah, I remember seeing that one too, but there was a different one than that.
Really?
I'm sure that you showed it to me. Maybe it wasn't you, but I feel fairly sure it was.
I don't know. Maybe I have it somewhere.
And, of course, then there was that picture of the beam coming out of the mountaintop.
You know why they didn't use that? They told me is...
wouldn't print?
It wouldn't show up well enough to be worth anything, especially in black and white.
Yeah.
I do show it when I give talks.
Uh-huh.
And it makes people wonder, because it seems like... that might be coming from the Starfire Range, but the Starfire Range is at the south end mm-hmm. of the Manzano Mountain, and that beam is coming from the middle of it, from behind it, which is approximately, I think, where the Sandia Lab is.
Well, that beam, as near as I could tell it, was coming pretty close to where Coyote Canyon is behind that one peak.
Right. Where the Sandia Lab was that you took a picture of that looks like a snowdrift when it was developed?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but a bit further to the east than that point, if I figured it out, you know, based on what I'd figured.
Uh-huh. So there was something being shot up into the sky that you couldn't see with your normal eye.
I never saw that. I just took that picture, and there it was.
At a thousandth of a second, you've
right.
saw...
Benowitz said, you know, take pictures, and so I did, and on that one, there was something.
Well, here's another reason why they would have been very worried about the man, because he was doing all kinds of things to try and figure out what he could see, what was going on there, because he thought that aliens were in some cahoots or having one over on the government, and he was trying to tell them about it. So, with all his expertise brought to bear on this very secretive place, which basically nobody sees anything if they're not looking for it, Benowitz had all of his attention turned on it. And because of this, they try to get his attention turned away from it, and hence we get the beginnings of underground bases, mutilations. Well, the mutilations is an open question. I didn't really address it much in the book. Alien abduction rights in exchange for technology, etc. These things that made the rounds in the late 80s and then really heated up in the 90s. I noticed that probably in the last maybe 6 or 8 years, those kind of rumors have taken are quite dead and taken a really big backseat to...
Very much so. It seems as if all of that kind of activity just...
It died
stopped.
Out.
Stopped. And, you know, why that is, or... I don't know that anybody
really has
addressed
that. Some people
still
believe it. The funny thing is where I notice it most now is in movies and TV shows.
Yeah.
That it lives on in that kind of medium. Because it's exciting. The fact that it's a lot of it's not true doesn't matter because it's movies and TV.
I venture to say that one of the things that has happened with the so-called UFO community and the disparate group of people that call themselves researchers within it is that it seems as if a game began many years ago, perhaps as far back as the Adamski crowd. And the name of the game was "Can You Top This?" And so each person who would rise to prominence in the field would have to have something that would top the one before them.
Mm-hmm.
So Adamski came out with his shtick, and not long thereafter, others of the stripe came along and elaborated on it. They had to be better than he was, and so suddenly there were beautiful women, and there were
Aura Raines was much better than
much better than Orthon of Venus or whatever it was.
And of course, Adamski came out with another book where he did hang out with women on a ship on the other side.
Yes, he had to join the crowd, and so it seems to have snowballed from that point on through the 60s, when suddenly we begin to get landing and trace cases coming into the situation, and then in the late 60s, abduction cases begin to make their appearance. And finally from the abductions, we have these weird medical exams and sexual encounters and everything else imaginable. Following on that, we had Benowitz, who literally topped the whole thing, because suddenly we have an invasion and 20 million people have been implanted with alien implants and are at the beck and call of evil aliens who are out to control planet Earth. And here's Benowitz telling me about these poor suckers out there on Lover's Lane and the West Mesa getting abducted every Friday and Saturday night, and they don't even know it. And, he's as serious as he could be about it.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think he was playing a game of can you top this.
No, I don't think he was. But I think others who took his material and his story, the John Lears and the Bill Coopers of the world, they were.
Uh-huh.
And for them, Benowitz was a very convenient, what shall we say, occurrence.
Yeah.
A piece of window dressing that they could use and embellish. And certainly Cooper embellished, even embellished upon his embellishments.
Yeah.
And Lear much the same way. You know, these people were getting large pieces of attention and loving it, and each one would have to come out with something greater than the other. And the result was that there was nothing left to top. If you couldn't produce an alien in the flesh,
you couldn't top anybody.
You couldn't
anymore.
Top it, because even the alien autopsy film, which they came out with and which proved to be defective, was a topper, an effort to top something else.
Yeah. Well, and many people would say that about the MJ-12 documents, that those were out and topped everybody.
True.
But that wasn't because you wanted to do it so much, I would think, knowing your nature, but it was because it was handed to you, and then you were threatened that somebody else was going to reveal it first. And, well, that actually brings something. Falcon told you that Tim Good had received it as well, and he was going to release it.
That's right.
And so you came up out at the National UFO Conference in Burbank in 87.
Yeah.
And with Jamie and Stan Friedman, did bring those documents out and introduce them. But you had said to me that you weren't quite finished, nowhere near finished, trying to figure out if they were authentic or not.
No, we weren't, and we literally got forced into the open with it. And
but at the time, you said you thought
difficult
they were
results. And to this day, I don't know whether they are or are not. But yeah. I feel reasonably confident that at least the one from the National Archives is authentic, and based on good evidence. But the trouble is, it doesn't mention UFOs. It only mentions MJ-12.
Right.
So what is it? It doesn't really tell us much.
Well, Bob Wood and his son Ryan are absolutely convinced that MJ-12 had something to do with UFO, or did, was the, what it says it was in the Eisenhower briefing memo.
And it may well have been. I never got to the point where I was 100% convinced by it, but yet I feel that there was a group by that name, may still be, and that they had something to do with the subject, if only to make an assessment of it at the very minimum level. But they must have had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly existed as late as the very early 1980s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's 25 years ago now, so who knows what the story is today.
Right. Which, strangely enough, brings us back to the book, because that is a very direct fallout from the Binowitz affair, as far as you're concerned,
yes.
Because
yes.
That was, I don't know, the third or fourth kind of document that got dropped in. This was actually Jamie, but since he knew you,
mm-hmm.
Got dropped into your hands.
That's
Jamie's
right.
Very interesting character, too, and I mentioned in the book that Jamie Chandra, that you found out that he had been working for some sort of intelligence capacity at least since the late 60s.
Yes.
And he
and
was
I didn't know that.
Yeah, civilian contractor kind of thing. You just thought he was somebody you met somewhere.
Yeah.
Working right. on a project. Was that by chance, do you think?
Well, he got involved in a pilot project to make a documentary film in 1978 or 79. Must have been 79. And they were looking for a writer. And so that's how I got to know him. I did a sort of a rewrite of one of their scripts, and then the project turned out that the man that was financing it was involved in a lot of things, and it just fell through.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just didn't go anywhere. It was called UFO Chronicles, I believe. I was trying to think of the name of it, but I think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And some film was shot, and some things were done, as is the case with all film projects, and this one never went anywhere.
But do you think that he was... Here's the conspiratorial side going. Do you think that he got in touch with you just by accident, or... Was he looking for
you? I don't know that I ever really did know how he came to be involved with that project. That's a good question. And
how did you get involved with it?
Stanton had somehow gotten wind of it and knew that they were looking for a writer or was involved with it as a consultant or something.
Uh-huh.
And, but I just, that's a good question. How did Jamie start out with it? Where did he come into it at? I don't know.
Okay, well, why do you... now I'm asking you a question.
He was basically
again.
A movie producer out uh-huh. here in Hollywood and did a documentary, did one on Albert Schweitzer and
mm-hmm.
and so on. And he wasn't a major player, but he was around and did a lot of commercial work and so on.
Minor he made a living.
Minor, made a living at it. And in any case, I was at a meeting with him. And two other gentlemen, and one of the two was a CIA man, and we were sitting all in this room, and this CIA gentleman looks at Jamie and says, "Now you, I've known about you for 16 years." And then he looks at me and he says, "But we haven't known you for nearly that long."
Yeah.
And so I thought, now what is he talking about 16 years with Jamie? What's that all about? At first I'd heard that. That surprised
yeah.
me.
This was a CIA person.
This was a CIA man. Yes, uh-huh. it was. And so I later asked Jamie about that, and he came up with some story about having done some film or audio tape analysis. I think it was audio tape analysis. And that had gone back to the time of Vietnam.
Huh.
And he didn't really say too much about it. He did say that something about having appeared in court one time as a witness on an audio case
right.
that he was getting somebody off the hook that supposedly this tape was faked.
Right.
And they were...
Court-martial case or something.
Something like that. I don't recall what that was. But it surprised me, and he never would say much about that. And it's clear to me that he definitely was known to them, and that he had some dealings with them for some years back.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't to know about that. I guess that was a slip, or maybe it was a deliberate slip.
Yeah.
But I never
Just
got
to let
to the
you
bottom
know there might
that.
Be more going on.
Yeah, I never got to the bottom of that, and I always thought when Jamie just sort of dropped out of the scene back in 99,
I was going to get to that.
that perhaps they had tapped him to do something covert, and that he just dropped out of the scene to do that.
Yeah.
That was my thinking, that made no sense of anything else.
I think he got divorced after that, too.
Yes, he did. At least I'd heard that he did.
Yeah. That was my question. Fast forwarding over all the things you did together, you know, why do you think he dropped out? And that was my, after talking to you about it, that was my guess, too. And he actually still is in Los Angeles, and there's a few people I've talked to that have seen him.
I've heard this from you, but I've not heard from anybody else.
And know where he lives. Hmm. But the reason I didn't contact him for the book was I didn't think he would want to talk to me. Might.
That makes sense, because he certainly knows how to find me if he wants to.
Yeah.
And the last time that we met, which was over lunch in, 90...
October 98?
98. It would have been November, I believe. October or November of 98.
No, in December he left.
We were on friendly terms. We had a good conversation. I recall telling him that I was involved with his other book project with the Mormon thing, and I basically was going to be spending a lot of my time on that, and if something came down regarding UFOs, they knew where I was, and all they had to do was call me or contact me, and I was available. But otherwise, I was going to shift gears. And it seemed like everything was fine, and that's the last time I saw him. Then when I tried to contact him again, his phone was no good, and nobody knew where he was.
Exactly. Yeah, I got another. This was in December, right after he said he'd be back. He said he'd be back December 10th or something. I called in mid-December, and his number was assigned to somebody else already with nothing. It just another woman answered and said, "People keep calling asking for this Chandray person. I have no idea who you're talking about." Now, if that was some number that where she knew what was going on, it was supposed to say that, I don't know, but I don't think so. She seemed genuinely bewildered that so many people were calling her.
I do know that immediately before that, before my luncheon with him, I maybe shouldn't say immediately, but within 2 months of that, I would say, anyway, he had gone to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he told me about this.
And he had a very strange meeting with someone.
But it wasn't Falcon.
As far as I know, it wasn't Falcon. But, you know, he just couldn't tell me who it was and wouldn't say much about it, except that it was at the National Cathedral.
He told me that, but he told Walter about this.
It was in the basement of the National Cathedral, in a place that was normally kept locked, that was just mysteriously open, and they went into this kind of crypt and had a conversation in there. And he could not tell me what it was about, and he could not tell me who this person was, and so that kind of gave me a clue that something was up. And based upon that I made my presumption that they had tapped him for something else and that he just had to go undercover.
When I was talking to him, well, we'll get back to the book at some point, but this is tangentially
yes.
connected to it. This is interesting to me, though, because when I was talking, we've talked about this, when I was talking to him at that time, I was talking to him probably about once a month for about 6 or 8 months. I don't know why he was talking with me. Maybe I'd contacted him first. Well, we were talking about a lot of things. But the last thing I remember him mentioning was this meeting. And I don't know who brought it up, but he says, I know there's another civilization here. It's extraterrestrial. It's visiting the Earth. The government knows about it. They've contacted them. There's an exchange of information, and not technology, but they know about each other and they communicate. There's an ongoing contact. Well, Jamie, how do you know that? Well, I can't. I was shown something. I said, where were you shown something? He said, I can't tell you. It was in the Southwest somewhere. He also told me about this meeting in Washington. I said, well, what was it? He said, I can't tell you. I was asked not to talk about it. I said, you can talk about your belief, and you can talk about how this changed your mind and made you absolutely sure, but you can't tell me how. No, I can't. And he did the classic, if you guess what it is, I'll tell you. And I spent about 5 months trying to guess what the damn... I asked people. I tried to get all my friends thinking about it. Nobody came up with anything. And, you know, he wasn't... He said he was shown something. It wasn't a ship. It wasn't an alien. It wasn't a video. It wasn't a film. It wasn't a document. It wasn't a dead alien, which can be faked, as we know. It was... All these things can be faked. It was none of these things. And I said, well, I've gone through everything, Jamie. What you're telling... What the only thing I'm left with is some sort of... You know, the same kind of belief somebody has when they have a religion. They just... Their faith can... You know, they... He goes, no, it was a thing, and I was shown... This is... And I was shown it.
I might speculate on that. I don't know whether I dare speculate on it, but why not?
And it could have been something that faked him out and just made him believe. I don't know.
Well, with the caveat up front that this is strictly speculation and that I do not know for a fact that this is what he saw, I'll just throw this out there. There was talk... Falcon mentioned this several times.
This is new. I haven't heard this.
Benowitz on one occasion must have been told about it because I seem to remember him saying something about it. But the story is that there was something which was called an orb or a crystal.
Is this what they talked about on the Cover Up Live thing? That you could see pictures in?
Yes. And basically that's what it was. It was sort of an operating crystal ball.
Which anybody could look at and see things.
And see things.
At a certain angle.
That's right. And I never saw that. I never even got close to seeing it. Nobody ever said, we're going to show you this, and then didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder whether maybe somebody showed Jamie that, and that's what it took to convince him. I don't know.
Maybe
that's the only thing I can think of.
Maybe it also convinced him to keep working, and it also convinced him to change his life and stop talking to anybody he had known before and do whatever he was going to do after that.
It could be. It may be that it showed him something about his own future that he needed to know in order to keep going. I just don't know. And I'm only speculating that that's what he saw.
Yeah.
And that's on the assumption that such a thing even exists.
Right.
And I can't say for sure that it does.
Uh-huh. Walter.
Just one interjection here, because I'm definitely a listener. This is way beyond my knowledge and very fascinating, but you touched on something that's familiar in my realm of, I guess, learning and from mentorship.
Walter, in case people don't know, the reason you're here and we're friends and all that, why don't you tell people what your background is a little bit?
Oh, I'm a former AFOSI agent. And I've forgotten all the things.
FBI?
Former FBI counterintelligence specialist, that kind of thing. And I'm in the World Explorers Club. And Craig, how did we meet? We met through a conference of David Childress's, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Without getting off the track
with everybody
what
else
you guys are saying,
scared of you for some stupid reason.
When you mentioned the thing about the orb thing, in my realm of things I've heard about, I have been told about, and I've never talked about this with you, I don't think. But
we're on the radio.
There are
now,
these plates that allegedly exist. That's how it was described to me. And I was told this was done to someone I know. And I can tell you the story at another time when
okay.
It's more appropriate. But the individual's hand was forced onto this plate, and he was shown his fate or his, you know, he was shown something that literally put the fear of God in him. And what you said about the orb, what you said about maybe he was shown his future or something, had a resonance with what I was told about
mm-hmm.
this plate experience.
Right.
And just in general, the idea of this crystal orb thing, that's interesting that there was something about that going around, because I was also very specifically told about these eyeglasses, spectacles that were not optical, but were able to show something of the past. And that's, again, a topic for another discussion, but that just kind of, that's very interesting, because it matches in the realm of some things I've been told, for what that's worth.
And this was through an Air Force type conduit, right?
No. This is through my mentor that I have mentioned.
Oh, okay.
You know, the man who got me into my career.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But no, I did not learn this through Air Force channels.
No, but it was the experience was associated with somebody who was in the Air Force.
You mean the thing about the plate?
Uh-huh.
No. This was someone a little more personal to my life.
Oh, okay.
And again, that's another. I don't want to get off the back of the book.
All right.
You got to wonder, and again, we speculate, but whether the question of remote viewing somehow ties into this, because at least in my somewhat limited contact with the remote viewing crowd, one of the things that stuck in my mind was that they seem to be able to transcend time.
Yes.
As well as location.
Yes.
And that seems to fit in with this apocryphal orb.
Yeah.
That it could transcend time.
You notice they never talk about the time transcendence very much in the literature. It's always place.
You got to figure that if there are aliens coming here from any other system, they have got to have, in some way, mastered time,
mm-hmm.
or at least found some way to partially negate it, or other possibility that they live 100,000 years or something. I mean,
right, exactly.
Presuming that they have a lifespan that is even 100 years, 1,000 years, you'd still think that they would have had to have some sort of mastery of time, or at least the ability to alter the passage of time so that it doesn't affect them.
Yes, or more importantly, to negate the fact that we have to look at things.
Morris Jessup, all the way back in the 1950s, was talking about the question of whether anti-gravity would possess anti-time technology or characteristics, not technology, but characteristics, and. My understanding from the experiments been done with antimatter and so on since is that antimatter does not seem to possess anti-gravity, and therefore it probably doesn't possess time qualities either. But I think that research is very much still in its infancy. It's very hard to do much with it with our technology.
Right.
So who can say? I mean, it's an interesting question,
mm-hmm.
but it's a question.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the book too, because when the Rick Doty told me they interviewed Myrna Hansen, because she had mentioned stuff in her hypnosis with Leo Sprinkle that she had mentioned going underground into these various areas, and she
mentioned going into that one bunker and the floor going down. And where did she get that at? I don't know, but that place existed.
Yeah, she described it fairly accurately, and as far as they knew, she'd never been there.
Yeah.
And I sort of speculated in the text that perhaps she, in the midst of whatever happened to her during this abduction, whatever that was, I'm not prepared to say it was aliens that picked her up and did a medical exam and all that. Maybe it was. But in the midst of this, or some other experience she had, maybe she knew somehow, or the point was that she was going to be interviewed by these people, so there was kind of a quid pro quo with the idea in her mind that she was going to be interviewed at Kirtland Air Force Base, and somehow her mind was able to travel to this place. And I don't know what the purpose was for getting them all excited about knowing about this underground area in Manzano. But was it Manzano? I think she told me it was in. Rick told me it was specifically in the mountains somewhere.
Yeah,
and
it's actually the bunker in question is actually outside of the perimeter fence. It just sort of sits off by itself. But it goes the floor.
Was that the one that you saw?
The floor goes down, and when you get down there, there's a tunnel. And where that goes, I've got to presume it goes to Manzano because it goes in that direction, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know where it goes. I just know that building exists and that floor is actually an elevator.
Is this anywhere near that Lovelace facility, or is it a different place?
It's not as far. If you go out that road to Lovelace, it's before you get to that.
Yes, there's a medical facility that used to at least be run by the Lovelace Medical Center that's actually a large hospital in Albuquerque. People go, it's like, you know.
Yeah, Lovelace is a big clinic there. But
yeah.
there were two facilities. on Kirtland that I knew about. One was abandoned and one was still active.
The abandoned one I did not mention in the book. The abandoned one is very interesting to me. I don't know why I didn't say anything about it, probably because it didn't really have any relevance to the story. But you had mentioned seeing some kind of device there that looked like it was for testing animals or something like this. It lowered them down into a floor, possibly in an area of radiation.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was old and disused, and you said it didn't look like it had been used in quite a few years. Well, and this was in the 80s.
Yeah, that's right. I spent probably the better part of an hour wandering around that place.
Was anybody watching you while you were there?
Not especially. I was with two other people, and, you know, we had business on the base, so we weren't particularly subject of anybody's interest.
So they didn't care if you went wandering around wherever you wanted to.
Well, this area sort of at that time, I don't know, who knows what's there now, but at that time, it just sort of sat off by itself in a little field, and it was an enclosure, had a fence around it, a wall kind of around part of it.
Said it looked like an old ranch house and
converted
into something.
There was a building in the front that actually had a porch on it. Looked like a ranch house. And then there were buildings around that, sort of in a, I don't want to say semi-circle, but in a fairly close area. There were maybe five or six buildings.
There was a compound there, yeah.
Yeah. And there was even a guard tower, which was partly dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't, the gate was open, there wasn't any sign, you know, no trespassing, there was no radiation sign, it was nothing. It was just all overgrown, dusty and dirty, it hadn't been used in a
abandoned,
long time.
Yeah.
And so I wandered around there, and one of the two people I was with seemed to know something of the history of the place and was talking about how they had used this to determine the effect of radiation, to determine lethal doses of radiation, determine the effect of the radiation on tissues and living tissues and so on, and where they would put these animals on a slab, basically, and strap them on it. And then this thing would go down on a couple of cables, chains, with a pulleys, into an area beneath the floor. And apparently that's where they would have their irradiation equipment down there, and they would irradiate these animals and monitor the results. At least that's what I was told they did, and looked to me like that's exactly what it was for, because that was the equipment that was there. And at least two of the buildings in the compound were buildings that appeared to have been built to house animals.
Uh-huh. So if you bought a bomb from the government, you could be sure that it was tested on animals.
Yeah, and by animals, I'm saying animals the size of goats or sheep or pigs, not horses and cows, but small livestock. And in any case, that was one of the compounds, and supposedly that was used in the late 1940s and into the middle 1950s, and then was abandoned at some point before 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another facility, which was further out. Actually, if you took the road that went all the way out to the solar tower and then went past the solar tower, there was another facility out there that belonged to Loveless. Red brick, kind of a compact little building with a parking lot in front of it.
Yeah, I think that's where they took Marie Hansen, too, to be x-rayed.
That would fit, yes, because that was still active at the time. And my understanding of that, and apparently yours too, was that the terminal cancer patients and people with the severe radiation disorders and the like were taken out there, and in some cases experiments were conditioned, in a last-ditch effort to learn something from them or to try to help them. But beyond that, I don't really know much about that facility. I don't even know if it's still active.
Mm-hmm.
But I know it was at that time very active, and there were probably a dozen or more cars in the parking lot that I can recall seeing. So it was quite a few people connected with it.
Right. Still going at the time. You know what? We should take a short break, I guess, for a couple of songs, and so I can change CDs over. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about the book, and then in the last half hour, see if we can get people to call in. The number's on the website, but I'll give it out here in probably about 10 minutes. We're talking with Bill Moore, who is supposedly interviewing me, who authored Project Beta, the story of Paul Benowitz, national security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth.
Well, once we get through our songs and so on, I have another question I'd like to throw at you.
Oh, okay. Well, if you can think of any, too, please go right ahead.
Okay.
All right. Wait, did you get a copy of the book yet?
No, not yet.
Good. Then I'll give you one.
Okay.
Okay. I've played these songs before, but it's much easier just to have them on. You knew about Nervous Norvus, right, Bill? He did Transfusion. Remember
that
song?
Transfusion.
Yes. He had a couple songs about flying saucers. I couldn't believe this when I got a collection of his old records on CD. What's this one called? Kibble Cobble, the Flying Saucer Song.
And that never turned up on Dr. Demento, huh?
No, it didn't. Not as
it
far
was
as
always
I
Transfusion.
It was always Transfusion, yeah. For all you Dr. Demento fans. Is this real? Somebody just sent an email, instant message. Doc Hunter S. Thompson is dead by suicide. So either he's dead by suicide, this person is lying, or Thompson is lying. But we'll check up on that one. It's Radio Misterioso, and we'll be back in probably about 4 or 5 minutes here. See if I can get this working.
Well, Sandra D died today, so there's got to be two more famous ones go, right?
Now I thought flying saucers were only a myth, that people from other planets didn't exist. But since they have landed here from outer space, there's cups hunting saucers all over the blaze. Yeah. Now Ipercon and Kipperching, they journey down to Earth to do some visiting. And the dance they did was the funniest thing, for as they danced together, every one of them would sing. Handa of a Mia my Amanda, and a Mia my Amanda, she a take a my Handa. We a kibble cobble too, we a kibble cobble fro, and though the music speedy never let her hand go. Chongo chango husky chesty fellies, take the hand of their slender villanellies, each one a singing as they twirl and whirl. Kibble dee, cobble dee, wind up and swirl. Come all ye cups, each grab your galley, oh, and spin her around and round. Don't let her down before you toss her into the nearest whirling, twirling, flying saucer. This ends the bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble. Chongo chango husky chesty fellies, take the hand of their slender villanellies, each one a singing as they twirl and whirl. Kibble dee, cobble dee, wind up and swirl. Body cups, each grab your galley, oh, come to the bottom, don't let her down into the nearest twirling, twirling, flying saucer. This ends a bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble. This ends a bibble bobble dance of kibble cobble.
Take me long to get settled down, but when I dug the cool chicks in every town, I said, this is it, cat, let's get earthbound. I'm the Fang, I'm the Fang, I'm the Fang. I got a bebop cap man, a real stingeree, and a solid gold keychain down to the knees, and real nervous pegs with a crazy crease. I'm the Fang. The Fang. I'm the Fang. Man, I'm feeling just like a newborn colt. I'm gonna hit these chicks with a Martian jolt, cause I'm a red hot daddy with a 1,000 volts. I'm the Fang. I'm the Fang. I'm the Fang. Now I meet this earth cat and he says, hi, you all. Man, you're real nervous. You feel like a ball. I said, sure, daddy. He said, let's find a hall. He didn't know I was a Fang. The Fang. The Fang. So we dug a cool hall and tried it on for size, and all the cats were jumping to a rock and roll cry, and every Melaroony chick just glued her eyes on the Fang. On the Fang. On the Fang. My feet started flashing like the noonday sun, and my blue suede were hotter than a $2 gun, and the chicks all yelled, daddy, oh, you're the one, you're the Fang. You must be the Fang. You're the Fang. Now when I left that hall about 12 midnight, I was an outer space papa that was feeling right, because every chick in the house was mine on sight. Man, I'm the Fang. I'm the Fang. I'm the Fang. I revved up my rod and a flask in the flight, and I sped through the stars back to Mars, my delight, and I know those earth chicks are dreaming tonight of the Fang. Of the Fang. Of the Fang.
Okay, there we go. That's the Fang by Nervous Norvus. Right before that was the Kibble Cobble the Flying Saucer song, also by Nervous Norvus. That's on a CD collection that I'm still putting together. I think I put one on the preliminary that I gave you, Bill. So when we went away, we were talking about the Kirtland Air Force Base and what might be going on there. If you're just tuning in, this is Radio Mysterioso, and Bill Moore is interviewing Greg Bishop, the author of Project Beta, about Project Beta. The strange thing is that he's one of the main characters in it, and maybe we should continue on with a little bit about the book in case people are curious as to what's going on in there, and then we'll go off on a tangent like we did before, which I don't mind at all. And then probably in about 10 minutes here we'll take some calls if you want to call in.
Well, Greg, I was interested in... We got that on... There we go. Greg, I was interested in the fact that in your book you have a number of pages of transcriptions from these alleged messages that Benowitz was decoding, that he claimed was coming from aliens. And I was wondering what you thought about those the first time you encountered those. What crossed your mind? What sort of image did that bring to you? And how did you, once you saw those, how did that change your impression of Benowitz?
Well, I had been front-loaded on the Benowitz story by you and by other people, and the front-loading gave me the impression that he was kind of obsessed to begin with, and then got more and more so as time went on, and this was just, you know, icing on the middle level of the cake. And if I looked at it and didn't know where it had come from, if I had not been, like I said, front-loaded on what it was, I would have thought it was just it was crazy writing by a person that had gone nuts. But Benowitz didn't write this. This is what he said he was picking up on his radio setup that was monitoring the signals coming out of Kirtland Air Force Base, which worried the AFOSI and specifically the NSA, apparently, which is what I've been told by a couple of people. So, yeah, my first impression was kind of, well, no wonder. No wonder he got more and more obsessed, because if you're ready to believe that this is important, you're ready to believe a lot of things.
Yeah, that's true.
Jump! Our planet is dying. We need no women. We know we can trust you. Things like that. There's a reproduction of the actual page in there. One of the pages.
The orange base under the mountain, and water is scarce. Seems to come up constantly in the situation.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I never could quite understand, is why, you know, water would be scarce on a planet which is virtually all water.
Yeah.
And but yet that's one that that consistently came up.
I thought it meant water was scarce from where they came from.
Maybe. But
I guess he interpreted it as there, it would be very, you know, they got water from some place, and he figured out if that was the basin Dulce, it was this, the Navajo River, which apparently flowed by Archuleta Mesa.
Yeah, that's right. There was some talk about the Navajo Dam and so on there.
As far as I know, nobody was ever found any tunnels, inlets, outlets, vents into the river,
anything like that.
They found maybe some vents on the mountain on Archuleta Mesa, but as Rick said, whether you believe them or not, they were put there to make people think there was something under there. Now, the point with that is that I've brought up with people, it's like, well, there were vents up there. I said, well, have you seen them? No, I talked to somebody who did. Did they describe them? Yes. And I said, did they notice if any air was going in or out of them? Well, no, they didn't check. It's like, well, then they could be just pipes stuck in the ground. Even if there is air going out or into these things, it might, especially, they better have a vent on it.
The first thing you want to do if you find a vent and you want to know if it's connected, and you put a match up to it and see if there's a flow of air.
Yeah, exactly.
Why they wouldn't do that, I can't imagine.
Maybe someone did, but I've never heard of such a thing.
I never did either.
There was one person, though, was very strange. He, I can't remember his name, kind of a heavyset guy, I think in the late 80s, early 90s, going around saying he worked in the base, and he was trying to out the base and tell everybody what was going on there. And I can't remember his name. However, very interesting thing, Gabe Valdez showed me letters from his wife, because he had died in like 91 or 92. I think it was kind of a German name or a Jewish name. I can't remember. But she seemed to think that he was killed. And she wanted Gabe to find out who did it. And she says, you know people in the government, don't you? You used to be in the police. Can't you do this? And this was, you know, 6-8 years after Gabe had retired from the State Highway Patrol. And this woman for, I guess, a few months just kept sending him letters imploring him to help find who had killed her husband. And I can't remember if it was suicide or he'd gotten suddenly ill or something like that. But he had died very soon after he started talking about this. Now, there's so many explanations for that. The conspiratorial thing is, they killed him because he was talking. But that's the only time I've ever heard of somebody saying they actually saw the place and were inside it.
Well, I know that there were only a few dirt, I'd call them roads, I guess, if you wanted to, but they were really more like tracks that went into that area. And I know that at one point somebody had gone through there with a bulldozer and had heaped up big mounds of dirt and put logs across the connected where those roads would connect with a hard road. And obviously they didn't want people going back in there. But who did that or why they did that, I don't know.
But who owns the land?
It was government land, as far as I know.
Really? Because I thought part of it was the Jicarilla Apache.
Part of it's the Indian reservation, and part of it's federal land, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because they were... one thing that Gabe had told me about what was going on there, there was that episode when Paul was up there flying some news crew around, and Gabe was with them, and... as they're flying around over the mesa, and he's pointing out, you know, that's where the base is, you can see this, that. I don't know whether they saw anything or not, or the people he was with saw anything, but all of a sudden this Apache helicopter came
up on them, yeah.
Yeah, and they got freaked out, and they went and landed at the little airport there, and soon after that, the helicopters landed there too, or one or two of them, and these Delta Force people jumped out, and they started fueling it. Well, they didn't know it was that. Gabe ran over to, he said, to see what was going on there. And he said they told him to keep away, and he jumped right on the helicopter to see who was in there before they chased him off. They said, "You have no permission to be here." And he said, "This is my jurisdiction. I should be able to find out who's doing what." And he said he saw a Delta Force patch on there because he knew what it looked like. Without any prompting, when I was talking to Rick, Richard Doty, he said that they had given the... I said, how did you make Benowitz believe that this stuff was going on up here in Dulce? He said, well, we put props up there, for one thing. that you couldn't really get to, but we flew him over them to look at them, you know, old Jeeps and little sheds and things like that, to point out to him that there was a base here, and this is what, this was part of it. But another thing they did, which, like I said, I didn't prompt him on a lot of things. He came up with these things by himself, or I'd give a little hint somewhere or another, and it would tumble out of him. And as much as I could get to match up with what UFO research and other people had told me, I would try to get some sort of idea what was going on. He said that they had told the Army Delta Force stationed at Fort Collins, Colorado, which was over the border in Colorado, that they were doing some sort of project that had to do with the Russians, which, according, you know, with the satellites, satellite surveillance and all that, essentially it was, that they were welcome to come and start flying over that mesa and doing some of their recon and their rescue operations and all that, their training in this area, specifically in this area of the Archuleta Mesa. And to sweeten the pot a little bit, they told them the Air Force would give them vouchers to reimburse them for some of the training, because they really wanted them out there and really wanted to make people think that there was a lot of interest there. So the Army was happy to comply. They flew out there all the time. They flew over people's ranches. They freaked people out. And this was just because they were hot-dogging and having fun in addition to doing their training. But for the people there, at least Benowitz and people that the mutilations were going on here, too, at the time, was a heavy concentration of them. They were putting two and two together and thinking, you know, on one hand, Benowitz says it's a base here that aliens are occupying and the government gave them permission. And on another hand, there's all kinds of military activity here and helicopters here and there all the time, kind of terrorizing us occasionally. And this is how this myth started to grow about there being a base near Dulce, New Mexico. This guy from the Navy, the Naval Intelligence, who turned out probably wasn't, he was trying to push that story on me too in the early 90s. He said he'd been there and seen these things. I went out there once, and I didn't go up into the mountains, and I didn't really see anything. I just went to the gas station in Dulce, probably about 88. Really nothing there. I mean, I guess there's a couple more hotels there now and so forth. But
there was one really nice hotel there when I was there.
Really, it was a Holiday Inn or something?
The only one in town. It was Best Western or Holiday Inn or something.
Yeah,
but there was just one. And there was a couple of stores. And
gas station.
There wasn't much else there. But I recall spending a day there. And in the company of a tribal policeman, an officer, not just a patrolman. I think he was a lieutenant.
You told me his name and gave told
Velarde.
Yeah, Hoyt Velarde.
Hoyt Velarde.
Yes.
And you know, hearing quite a lot of strange things from him.
Mm-hmm.
But
such
he,
as what? What things he'd seen?
Oh yeah, they followed things and seen. I think he was one of the ones that Gabe talked about when they cornered this thing in a field one night.
Oh, okay.
I think Hoyt was one of the three that was there.
All right.
But Hoyt took me in a literally across country. We were, I don't know, maybe took 45 minutes to get there, and through really back roads, but you had to know where you were going to get there, I guess. And we ended up in a place where there was a clearing.
Uh-huh.
It was surrounded by trees, but here was this clearing.
Right.
And in that clearing, there was a huge circle.
Oh, you showed me pictures of this.
Yeah, I did. I still have samples of the soil, both from inside that ring and outside of it. And nothing has ever been done with those. If somebody would come along and say, hey, we'd like to have those and do something with them, I'd be glad to donate them. But supposedly, I mean, he said, well, I'm going to take you out to see a landing spot. And that's where we went. And sure enough, there was this big circle on the ground. And clearly the soil was different, because mm-hmm. I did some scraping around, and you could tell the soil had been affected somehow. It wasn't the same.
Right.
And so something was going on. This thing was fully 100 feet across.
The circle?
Yeah, it wasn't.
Had anybody seen what made the circle?
I cannot recall whether they had or whether there was just lights in the area and they ended up going out there and then finding this thing. It seems to me that's the way it was.
Yeah.
No one had actually seen anything.
Just
on
because
the
there's not any base there doesn't mean there were weren't a lot of weird things
yeah.
going on out there.
Yeah. But you know, that is one of several things that I saw with my own eyes.
Uh-huh.
I also saw the ghost light out there with my own eyes.
Yeah.
In the little cemetery there.
That's in the book, actually.
What that was, I don't know either.
A blue light.
Was there. And when you got close to it, it went out.
You sure it wasn't a reflection off a tombstone from somewhere?
No, it was because it hovered above the tombstone.
Oh, okay.
And it clearly was not a reflection. Even Gabe said one night that he'd gotten the power people and shut the power out one night to cut
yeah.
all the reflections on. Made
yeah.
people mad, but...
Because they were watching a prize
right.
fight or something.
And but he said the thing stayed. It didn't go out.
Uh-huh.
There was one night when Gabe and I were standing out on a highway. We'd just gone out and were chit-chatting, and this green thing came up over the horizon. And it was at a great distance, and it wasn't moving very fast, but it was something. And we were both watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was green. It was bright green.
Was it...
Came up over the eastern horizon and hovered for a while and was gone.
Huh.
But at a great distance, and
yeah.
It didn't do anything spectacular. It just
yeah.
showed up and then it was gone. It was probably there 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But looking through it through binoculars, you couldn't tell what it was. It was just a light.
Yeah.
But certainly something in that area was going on, and it excited a lot of talk and a lot of people, and...
Right.
There was talk of cattle mutilations in that area, a lot of them, and talk of...
Not only talk, Gabe went out and looked at a bunch
of
them.
Well, yeah, that's true. And you saw the photos that I had, copies of the photos that I had from him, where in the one case you could clearly see some kind of a clamp mark on the animal's leg.
Yeah. I had Chris O'Brien on a couple weeks ago, and
yeah.
he said he saw some of that same activity.
I mean, that sort of thing is not something that would be easily faked. You put a mark like that in a cow's leg and then pick the cow up and drop it. That takes some effort.
Yeah, right.
That's not just a...
It's,
you know,
whatever it is, it's either aliens or quite well financed.
Things work. That's something.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing with the question of ultraviolet chemicals.
Yes.
On the animals. There were numerous instances of that.
Yeah, specifically that time with Howard Burgess, who did work at Phillips Labs.
Yeah, I
on
remember
the base.
Howard.
He had
a garage full of stuff. I was up at his house one time, and his whole garage was full of equipment.
What kind of equipment?
Electronic equipment.
He
was quite an experimenter in his own right, tinkerer, I guess you'd
yeah.
say. And he just had a whole garage full of stuff, his little laboratory there. But he was no fool. You have to give that man credit for being both intelligent and careful with what he was doing. He wasn't gullible, that I could see.
And he was the one that found out with Gabe that there were, and along with Manuel Gomez, who owned the cattle, that they ran them through a squeeze chute and shined
yeah.
lights of differing
yeah.
wavelengths on them. Ultraviolet, which is very easily obtained by anybody, seemed to indicate that it seemed to make these patches, these purplish sparkly patches, show up on the cattle. And these were the cattle that had been some of those showed up later mutilated, and all those cattle, at least Gabe told me, were from the same lineage.
Same breeding.
Yeah,
that's
somebody
that's,
had marked them. It wasn't one of the ranchers,
clearly. And as I've said many times, people have said, well, it's the CIA, you know, they were doing DNA experiments, early, you know, things and stuff. The problem with that is that no one in their right mind, in charge of a government project, wherein money would be spent and reports had to be made, would subject the entire security of their operation to the mercy of some irate rancher with a shotgun.
Yes, exactly.
Stumbling on them in the middle of the night and you know, taking a few shots at somebody. They just wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Especially when there are so many remote box canyons out in that area, they could just buy their own herd of cattle and do whatever they wanted and nobody
would. Well, the way a lot of these things happen, at least the way that Chris O'Brien had talked about, he was one that wrote Mysterious Valley, about the San Luis Valley. He he said that there are all kinds of things done with the cattle when they found them that it was surprising they weren't caught. Things like, he said one of the cattle was left inside a barn on top of a table. You couldn't lift the cow up. It was a steer. It was like, whatever, a 1,000-pound steer.
How in the world would you lift a steer up onto a table?
First they had to get
inside
it in the barn.
That would be a neat trick.
And the
quietly,
barn wasn't...
That they would bellow to the point where you yeah. for miles.
How yeah. sturdy was the table?
It was
yeah,
a very sturdy table.
Question.
It could hold... Well, it was, you know, a platform or a table, but they had left the cow in there, I think, in some kind of weird position. And who the hell... You know, what was the purpose of that? And it wasn't that far from the house. And there was another case where he said that there were some sort of people cooperating with trying to cover it up. And it was some kind of strange criminal element that was in the area that seemed to be cooperating with some of the people or whatever was doing these mutilations. They were seen in the area not soon after it, and they were evasive with their answers about why they had been there. They couldn't pin them to anything involving the cattle. It's a lot stranger than you think it is. There's even some sort of... people say, no, it's a bunch of Satanists or cultists. Well, but there's some evidence that it's that, too.
I know that when I was still living in Minnesota...
we said we're going to let people call, but yeah, just let me finish your thought here.
I had a conversation with... what was it? Flickinger or Flicklinger or what? Forget what
Don
his name
Flickinger.
Was. That's the man.
The ATF guy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I had a conversation with him. There'd been a couple of mutilation incidents in the area. And he said the one thing he couldn't understand was that because there was so much talk about devil worshippers and demonic people and so on, that there were literally posses of people out lurking about late at night trying to catch some of these people in the act. And
yeah.
They were all over the place, and yet nobody had ever seen anything.
And yet some of the mutilations and things occurred while they were out there.
Virtually within, 100 or 200 yards of where these people were staked out trying to catch somebody. The next morning, there would be something.
Yeah.
And, they would find an animal with a snow around it. And there wouldn't be any tracks in the snow except the animals. And yet the thing would be, there would be lips severed and ears cut and nostrils removed and other weird things. He was truly puzzled by it.
Yeah. He's I think he even had, I mentioned in the book too, that somebody came and smeared blood on his front door as some sort of warning for him to stay away from it.
Yeah, I remember that being talked about.
Yeah.
But, what do you make of that? That the people are out there trying to catch weird people running around in the middle of the night doing things, and yet things get done and nobody's ever seen?
Under their nose.
Yeah, literally right under their nose.
Yeah.
So something out of the ordinary was there.
And it's funny, Linda Howe notwithstanding, it seems like there's no one explanation that fits all the
evidence.
So therefore it's all of the explanation.
In that area of Minnesota, it was extremely flat, and if you happen to get at one of the high points, which might be 10 or 15 feet above the rest of the terrain, you could literally see a vehicle for miles at night coming because of the headlights.
Yeah.
And yet they wouldn't see anything.
Right.
We're being harassed here. There's an evil force loose in the studio. Help! Apparently somebody needs chairs in the other room.
Yes.
There.
No problem.
Yes.
As I promised, we would like people to call in if you're still listening and have a DSL line, which I can see by who's listening on which dial-up, speed line that I know some of you have. The number in the studio is 213-252-0998 if you'd like to call up and ask Bill or Walter. Yeah, Bill or Walter or I, any kind of questions about what we've been talking about the book, anything like that, 213-252-0998.
And we should add the caveat that we are only accepting intelligent questions tonight.
Yes.
So if you don't have an intelligent question, don't call.
What is the latest on the, for instance, the cattle mutilation thing? Have there been any occur lately or any revelations?
They're still occurring, but not nearly in the kind of frenetic wave that they were in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. there was an upswing in the late 90s, I think, in the Dulce area, and Gabe told me he'd been given money by NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, Robert Bigelow's organization, to go out there and provided with really good equipment to look into this. And he seemed to think, he came to the conclusion that a few other people have, is that, which is what his theory is now, is that there's some sort of virus, prion, something like that, loose in the animal population and domestic, and this somehow got released maybe sometime in the 70s, maybe the early 70s, late 60s, and it was spreading, and some of this was done in order to find out where this had spread to, and it would sort of explain why people were going in, or somebody was, something was going in and grabbing these things out of people's pastures, when if they wanted to do some kind of experiment, they could just get their own herd. But the thing is, they wouldn't have the sampling that they would have by going out to all these different places. And, you know, it fulfills other purposes, too, such as, you know, testing, you know, stealth kind of techniques. I'm not talking about, you know, stealth fighter, but ways of doing things without people noticing right under their noses.
Right.
And that's one explanation. I asked Linda Howe about that, and she said, no, absolutely not. It's all aliens. I said, well, how do you know that?
Geez.
And I said, well, what about the gas mask that Gabe found and the radar chaff, which wasn't really radar chaff, but that's what it looked like. Evidence of humans in the same area as these cattle when these things happen. She said, well, that's just the aliens doing that to make us think it's people.
So the ET filter was on her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, good. We've got a call. Maybe it's Linda Howe. let me see if I can get it.
How now?
Right. Yeah. Well, she's looked at far more of these than I have, so I don't know exactly what to say to her. Just a minute. Let me get the phone.
Still radio? Yes? It's still radio? Yes, it is. Bill Moore and Greg Bishop and Walt Bosley are here. Would you like to ask a question? Oh, it's Bruce McAvee.
Hey!
Just a second. Let me see if I can get the phone up here. It's very... there.
Are you still there? Do you mind giving your name out on the air?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Bill. I was wondering...
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I was wondering what you're doing nowadays, since we haven't heard anything from you. Except for this interaction with the book that's just being published.
Well, I'm still writing, but not about UFOs. I work part time for a newspaper, doing editorial.
I can't hear anything.
Oh, just a minute. Let me see if I can get it.
Maybe I'm not on here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Is that it?
Can you hear me now?
Barely.
Huh. Well, let me put the...
Way off in the distance.
Way off in the distance.
You're 3,000 miles away from me, so I guess that explains it.
Can you hear it now?
Sounds like you're talking.
Is this one any better? I'm on a different mic now. Did that help?
Yeah, that helps.
Okay, well, I'll use this mic then.
There we go.
All right, let's try again. I work part-time for a newspaper. I do editorial work and mostly advertising layout and so on. And I've been more of a historian than anything else the last decade. I've been involved in a project that will result in a book a little bit later this year on the history of the Book of Mormon and the question of Joseph Smith. And... it's called The Spalding Enigma. It will be published by Concordia Publishing House in a couple of months.
How about that?
But I've been just completely away from the UFO field and the field of the unexplained. I just felt I learned as much as I could learn. There's just nothing left to learn.
Okay, well...
I'm still alive and around and glad to hear from you. I haven't heard from you in quite a long time. What are you doing?
Well, I
hear you're retired.
Huh?
I hear you're retired. What are you doing?
No, I haven't retired.
Ah.
And occasionally still
I've
get out on
the West Coast. I've been disinformed. I knew it.
What?
I've been disinformed. I knew it.
Uh-huh. Disinformation all over the place.
Yes.
Well, of course, I'm interested in this book because I had a little piece of the action myself there.
Yes, I used some of your research, and you were quite helpful, and I thanked you in the book for your help. It was the piece on
Kirtland
Air Force. Yeah, the Kirtland sightings, yes.
In my attempt to browbeat Doty.
Yes, exactly. Did you know Doty and Robert C. Collins are coming out with their own book very soon?
Yes, that's exempt from disclosure.
Yes, exactly. I don't know what the I don't know if that's what they're going to talk about is exempt from disclosure or not. I tend to think that we're going to have to look at it for quite a long time to figure out how much of it is actually useful.
Yeah, well, I hope that Doty comes clean, but will we ever know?
That's a good question. I don't think we ever will.
No. He seemed to be, you know, fairly open with me, but he also layered on a lot of bullshit, too, which my detector went off, and so did Bill's when I told him about what our conversation was. But he also provided a lot of useful information that seemed to check out, too, so that's mm-hmm. the nature of it.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that we're probably not going to know about what happened back in those days, and even more importantly, what's happening now, if anything.
Yeah. Well, what do you think is going on now? What is your position right now on this subject of UFOs? Where they come from? I know you take it on a case by case basis, but what keeps you interested?
Well, I guess I get most of my kicks out of the analysis part.
Uh-huh.
Trying to figure out whether or not something is explainable, and if it appears not to be, then analyzing my explanation, my attempted explanations or other people's explanations, and find out whether or not they make any sense. You know, like in the past 5 or 6 years, we've had Arnold's case raked over the coals with pelicans and so on. The question being, is there any explanation for that one particular case that makes any sense in terms of conventional science?
Uh-huh.
And as a physicist, where I'm interested in is trying to take a proposed explanation and analyze it from the point of view of whether or not it makes any physical sense.
Uh-huh.
It's been important to an important part of analysis of the New Zealand case of December 1978, the 1986 Japan Airlines sightings,
right.
Phoenix Lights.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's been Gulf Breeze, and most recently, the Mexican Department of Defense case. This is all stuff that's on my website.
Right. Oh, why don't you give that out so people know where to go?
It's http://brumac.8k.com. That's the number 8, letter K, brumac.8k.com.
All right.
And you'll find some 30 megabytes worth of juicy analysis there.
So I've seen some of your articles in the SSE Journal, which are very interesting. I'm sure you've got either part or most of those same analysis up on your site.
Yeah, and I'm going to be having another one coming out, I think, in the next issue on how I happen to get a couple of letters to the editor published in a technical journal called Applied Optics. It's the only UFO sighting that I'm aware of that was actually argued in the open refereed press, one portion of the December 1978 New Zealand sightings, resulted in a series of 3 letters to the editor that was published in that refereed journal way back in 79 and 80. And as you may be aware, that's the only sighting that was allowed to be listed as a reference for sightings in the recent paper, Inflation Implications for ET Visitation, that was just published in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. That's been mentioned on the UFO Updates list and some other places. That's a paper in a refereed journal published in Britain, the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. That was by Jim Deardorff, Bernie Hache, myself, and Hal Putoff.
Well, impressive enough credentials that people are well advised to pay attention. Is there anything you wanted to ask?
I think it's the first paper in a refereed journal to argue that you ought to spend some time looking at UFO sightings if you're interested in finding evidence of E.T.
Uh-huh.
The conventional point of view has always been, it goes back to sort of the Fermi paradox, which results in the question, where are they? There ought to be a whole bunch of civilizations out there. Most of the stars are a lot older than the sun. They could have civilizations around them which are much older than ours. People who have been, or intelligent life that's existed, I guess, as creatures, you might say, mm-hmm. for hundreds or thousands of years longer than we have, probably know a lot more about the physical universe than we do. They may know how to get here from there in quick time. And
or no time.
This thing called diffusion theory says that if just one civilization like that were to arise, it could populate the whole galaxy in 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 million years, which is a drop in the bucket compared to the age of the galaxy of about 13 billion years.
Uh-huh.
So the point is about the Fermi paradox is there ought to be a lot of people out there. They ought to be able to get to the Earth. So why don't we see any? And the conventional approach to the paradox has been, well, they're not out there. That's why we don't see them. Unconventional approaches have been, well, they're out there and they're visiting, but we're a zoo.
a drunken zoo, like yeah.
And our solution to the Fermi paradox is that they are here. It's just that they're being semi-covert, and our own self-cover-up is preventing us from admitting it.
There's a built-in blind spot based on fear, hubris, etc.
Right.
Bruce, since you're on the line here, I'd be interested in hearing just what your opinion is of the Benowitz affair. What's your take on that after all these years?
Well, I, of course, didn't have any extensive interaction with Benowitz, per se, and my own interest was not in Benowitz, but in the Kirtland Landing case itself, and as I said, trying to browbeat Doty into whether or not there was some other report on it. But I did talk to Benowitz once.
Mm-hmm.
I went to his Thunder Research. This was, I guess, in spring of '85. I went to the office and said I wanted to see him. I said who I was, and as a friend of Hynek and so on. But I think he was there, but he wouldn't see me.
Hmm.
He waited until I was about ready to get on the airplane. He says, then you can call. I can't remember how he got a hold of me, but he wanted me to call him back, so I called him back from the airport. I guess he figured he was safe because I was about to get on the plane and wouldn't be likely to come in and drop in on personally.
I wonder why he wouldn't.
On the telephone we were talking, and he was telling me about how aliens were always sticking needles in him.
Did he tell you which arm they went in?
The only reason he talked to me was because he was aware I was a friend of Hynek. And if it hadn't been for that, he wouldn't have said anything. He didn't say very much anyway, except for the general situation. The creatures were after him or something like that. And this bit about them, every time he turns around, they're sticking a needle in my neck or something. I forget exactly what it was, because that was almost 20 years ago now.
But, yeah, yeah.
So I know no more about the Benowitz sub situation, really, than what I've read. So for me to have an opinion on it would be an uninformed opinion, I guess.
Right.
I had always thought that he had gotten this stuff about Dulce from an abductee that he had worked with. I know that James, what was his name?
Harder.
No. The guy who wrote the book Ufology. Mac something.
McDonald?
McDonald.
Not McDonald. Can't think of his name offhand, but anyway.
I can't either.
He did. He got an aerial photograph of the area.
Uh-huh.
And we analyzed that, trying to compare that with a map that Benowitz had drawn. And Benowitz had drawn a map which showed the top of the Archiluta Mesa, supposedly, with a laser beam device, a crash disk, and other stuff.
Right.
And we always assumed that he was just seeing shadows that appeared to be something or other. Nothing showed up on the aerial survey, which had been taken some years earlier.
Right.
Now you're saying, or what I just heard you say on the radio, was that the people who are trying to disinform them actually put stuff on the top of the mesa.
Yeah, as
of
about
like something was there.
Yeah, as of about 82
so maybe,
or so.
Maybe he wasn't as nuts as we thought.
Yeah. Well, they directed him. They flew him up there in a helicopter. Doty with him one time, wearing those big helmets because they're in a helicopter, yelling at each other, and Doty pointing out these things that they had planted there for him to see.
Well, that could be the source of this map, which whose name I can't think of.
Mm-hmm.
He sent me a copy of the aerial survey, so I could look at it for myself. And as I said, the aerial survey had been taken some years earlier.
Right.
It didn't show anything.
Yeah, well, they
correspond to crash disks or whatever.
Uh-huh. Well, they would have that stuff would have been put up there probably in 81, maybe, I think, 81, 82, sometime around that period when they were flying him up there and trying to get his attention directed away as much as possible from Kirtland.
Right.
Actually, I think we've run over our time here, so I'll probably have to let the next show take over. But hey,
bad boy.
Yeah. Would you be interested in coming on and talking on the show at some point?
Sure.
Okay, well, I'll email you then and see if we can set something up, Dr. McAbee.
Okay.
Good hearing your voice again, Bruce.
Yeah.
You're doing well.
If you send me an email message at my website, Bill, maybe we can get in contact sometime.
All right, I'll do that.
Okay.
All right.
We'll see you.
Thanks
Bye.
Very much for calling. Okay, well, what a surprising call from Dr. Bruce McAbee.
Yes, indeed.
And
a welcome one.
Yes. Oh, there we go. I guess we'll have to bring Bill on at some other point, and he's perfectly willing to come on the show and talk. So if you want to call up the next time, we can't give you another date, but you can be certain that when he's going to be on, there will be an announcement made, as there is any time I have a guest on Radio Mysterio. So too bad, Walter, you didn't get to say too much.
I did that on purpose. Said I did that on purpose because you guys are way beyond me on this subject, and it was much more interesting to you are. I mean,
okay.
You guys know more about this, the things you talked about tonight than I do. I mean, you know, so I like to.
Well, he's just playing
dumb.
He knew everything. He was in the Air Force intelligence.
So, no, when you and Bill talk, I like to listen because I learn more than I can. Contribute
well, by I hope
far.
I hope other people like to listen too. I'm sorry we didn't have more time for the calls here, but it was nice to hear Bruce McAbee talk. I mean, whoever gets to hear Bruce McAbee on the radio. So, hope you enjoyed it. The book is Project Beta, the story of Paul Benowitz, National Security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth. That's a UFO myth, not the UFO myth. And that's at Amazon or any bookstore you could care to go to. It's all at all the big chains. And I want to thank Bill so much for being here and talking to me about about the book in which he's one of the main characters.
All right. There we go.
Yes.
Well, you're welcome, and it's been a pleasure to be on.
All right.
I'm glad the microphone is working again.
Well, we can have you on again very soon, I'm sure.
One of the joys of being local.
Uh-huh. And it's Radio Mysterio, so we're here every week, Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. here on killradio.org. Stay tuned there for Jackie and Ready, Set, Go. I'm sure she's just about ready to come in. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week, next time.